Today on Care Under Fire, I'm with Tom. Tom is a former military psychologist and intelligence officer who served in the Australian Army for 22 years. Tom specialised in critical incident mental health support and deployed to Afghanistan 6 times from 2009 to 2012. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Tom.
And thank you for having me, Em. And as a veteran yourself and someone who has helped people under operational conditions, I feel like we're kindred spirits, and I'm happy to support what you're trying to achieve here, sort of getting our stories out there.
Yes, so keen to hear about it. Where did it start for you? Tell me about your younger years growing up, and was there anything in that childhood that made you want to later understand and manipulate the human mind, so to speak?
I love your use of the word manipulation. We'll talk more about that later. So I am one of 6 children. I was raised in the country, and that gave me, I think, some of those skills that went on to be beneficial in the military in terms of living in austere environments, working in teams. But as one of 6, and I was a 3rd born, my parents had a very unhappy marriage, and when I went on to university and I started in science and transferred across to psychology, and I spoke to my mum about it, she said, well, that makes sense to me, because when your father and I were having challenges, even when you were a little fella, you'd be the first, even though that you weren't the oldest, you'd be the first one to come up and put your arm around me and go, you know, mum, are you okay? So I think that probably that spoke to my empathy as a child, and that's obviously an asset when you seek to support people as a psychologist.
Yeah, you can't learn that later. That's probably a trait that you either have or you don't.
Agreed.
Say in health in general, people are more attracted that want to serve and want to help people.
Yeah.
So you initially joined the Army Reserve as a GSO whilst you were still studying psychology at uni, is that right?
Yeah, so I joined in May 2002. I'd done some time earlier as a soldier at 2 Commando Company Fort Gellibrand, Melbourne, and that was really appealing. Spent some time there. I got a sense that there were things that I observed that I thought this could be done better, or as a private, I'm not going to be able to change things. So I was attracted to becoming an officer because I sort of was probably, you had that idealism that you could change things as a lieutenant and captain, which we later know that you can a little bit, not as much as we would hope. Yeah. So then, yeah, so I went into the part-time GSO program in May 2002 while concurrently practicing as a civilian psychologist in Melbourne.
And was that enjoyable, coming in and doing sort of general service officer stuff, separate, very different to what you were focused in your day job of psychology?
Absolutely. Yeah, like, listen, this is where I think we go through life trying to find where we fit. I think that's the key to sort of satisfaction and contentment. So for me, having that duality in my life of study and, you know, sitting in an office trying to understand and support someone, while also being able to exercise, you know, those more physical masculine traits that I sort of grew up celebrating, that was huge for me. So I was one of those reservists that did, you know, I'd do 100 days a year. I was working in schools at that point primarily. So during terms or during holidays, I would spend that on courses. And then, you know, when I graduated military college, I went across to engineers. I didn't want to go into psychology. I wanted to do something different. Went into construction and combat engineering, which was intellectually very stimulating. And then after 3 years of that, my life was so busy with psychology work and then reserves that I thought I would bring the two together, which I did in 2007 to transfer to become a full-time psychology officer.
And then what sort of training did you have to do, given that you'd already done some GSO work prior? Did they still make you go and do special service officer training and your ROBC and all that?
Yeah, so I was fortunate. I didn't have to do SSO, the knife, fork, and spoon course, which was good. I did go and do regimental officer basic training at where was that done? Sort of Bandiana, and that was really good, just in terms of establishing a cohort and teamwork within psychology. And it was also, one of the great things about the military is I think it's training. It can be very, I think for initial training, it's wonderful. It's standardized, it's proven. And when you complete that training and you start work, it just all gives you that common language and that common understanding to defer to. I don't like to be idiosyncratic. I think that's an issue in terms of when you're a leader. It's good for people to know what you know, so that you can maintain a standard, that you can identify when someone's struggling because they don't know what they should, so you can give some additional resources. So ROBC was, it didn't, it was more sort of an administrative course, but yeah, it certainly set me up for my later career. And probably what was the best training I ever received is down in Heidelberg, Melbourne. There's the Australian Centre for Post-Traumatic Mental Health, ACPMH, and that had some of the training I received there prior to deploying to Timor and Afghanistan 6 times was just extraordinary. It was very much leaders in PTSD training and treatment. So after having done that course, it was very much like, walking on the shoulder, standing on the shoulders of giants there. You just felt, when eventually I went on to begin my critical incident mental health support and operations, I felt extremely well trained.
Yeah, that's fantastic. How was the day-to-day in those early years? What were you doing for those that maybe, there's a lot of illusions about Psych Corps, I guess, so you can dispel them
Yes.
by explaining your job. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
yeah, happy to provide a ground truth on being a new psychology corps officer. So you've probably got a couple of lines. You've got the military line in terms of how you present yourself as a fellow officer within an all corps environment. And I think one of the keys there was humility. This idea about I know what I know, and you know what you know. And if you and it was obviously a combat corps dominated workplace where I was very clear that I was there to support the combat corps guys. And with my humility, I was able to, I don't know, I was fortunate. I probably orientated myself well so that people were very happy to talk to me and help me. Certainly when I went on to do my promotion courses, like I always had a good group of combat corps guys that were happy to help me with my chutes and maneuver and all that kind of stuff, which I found fascinating anyway. And I think as a psychology corps officer, fundamentally it's about you in a room with another human being for a purpose. So my first posting was to Kapuka, which is really, so your purpose there is to assess suitability for continued service with recruits. So at that time, Kapuka had a 14% wastage rate. So out of every 100 recruits that came in, 14 would not get through, 7 on site grounds, 7 on physical grounds. And I was very clear, I was, because I'd had my own soldiers as a reservist, and I had full-time soldiers then, and I had some excellent soldiers, so I kind of had a pretty good sense of what they looked like. So my sense was that, Defence Force recruiting would make an assessment as to whether someone was suitable or not. They'd get sent off to Kapuka, and so often, I thought they were accepting risk on our behalf. That, there were so many recruits that came through, and it was kind of like a rule of thirds. There was a third who it just wasn't their time. Like, you know, their girlfriend got pregnant, mum got cancer, whatever it might be, and they needed to leave. Another third, they were likely to become suitable, but were not at that point because they hadn't worked in teams, they weren't emancipated from home, they just weren't physically tough enough, and they were likely to become suitable. And you'd give a rating. It's like, hey, come back in 2 years upon evidence of this. And to speak frankly, there was a third who you probably wanted to sterilize because in no way were they going to contribute to our great nation.
Yeah.
You know, I think about guys that saying that, you know, they're going to go back to Hungry Jack's as a chef. And you're just like, what are you talking about, mate? And you'd hear people talk about, the military, I'm losing my individuality in the military. And you knew then that they didn't get it, that the military makes you all the same so that you can distinguish yourself by things that matter. You can distinguish yourself by being a good teammate. You can distinguish yourself by being good at your job, you know, not your music preferences or how you wear your hair. And the soldiers that, or the recruits that didn't get that, I was very happy to find them unsuitable. And personally, I didn't feel that 14% was possibly high enough. And one of the reasons for that is you'd see the recruit instructors staying back and helping these recruits that were struggling. They felt so professionally obliged to help every recruit through. And I wanted to take that burden from them because some of them simply weren't suitable.
Yeah.
And then from there, I went straight to one psych unit, which no longer exists, but that was our main operational unit. So its mission was to support commanders and soldiers on live operations. So I spent the next 9 of 12 years there. And that was a period of high operational tempo, certainly between, say, 2008. So I joined 2007, 2008, I'm in Timor, 2009 to 12, I'm in Afghanistan 6 times. And that's when the post-traumatic mental health courses I did and the critical incident management courses I had done, I found them to be excellent. They really set me up for success. And then, you know, you start deploying and deploying frequently. There were years that I spent 6 months away. Of those 6 deployments, there was a couple that were as short as, you know, 3 weeks to a month, but most of them were sort of at the 5 month mark.
Wow. So you specialized in this critical incident response space. Can you tell us just a bit about, obviously I sort of know what they do, but many probably don't.
Yeah.
But yeah, when something goes down overseas, someone dies or there's a huge event, you fly in and provide some psych support.
Absolutely. So the conditions that I did it under were both, I would be sort of a part of a short notice to move team, or I was already embedded in the psych support team in Afghanistan. So to speak about being on a short notice to move team, one example is Kabul 2011. There was a vehicle-borne IED strike that killed 25 soldiers and 4 locals. Taliban had, I think, 700 kilograms of HME in a ute, drove up alongside a US armored Rhino bus and detonated. And 48 hours later, I was in Kabul providing on-the-ground support to soldiers and commanders that had responded to that event. So what happens in that 48 hours prior to getting on the ground? I won't talk about preparing equipment, all that kind of stuff. That's pretty standard, but you're gaining as much information about what happened, what the exposure was, who was exposed. And this is where we do a good stakeholder analysis to go, okay, clearly there were those who directly responded to the incident and were pulling bodies out of the springs of seats. You've got body parts falling apart. You've got first responders who are dealing with locals, like the bus unfortunately landed on a bus stop and killed some young children who were waiting for the school bus to take them to the school that morning. So you've got to think about the stakeholders that were involved, and that can be obviously those who are on the ground, those who receive them at hospitals, those who might have provided aeromedical evacuation, those who weren't present but they were coordinating via radio. So, and it can even go down to those who were supposed to be on that bus, but for whatever reason missed it that day, and what it might mean for them. So, the model that we apply is one that was born out of rape crisis centers in the United States. So, when you think about a group that is exposed to trauma and a group that can be that is perpetual and is studied and has in like a longitudinal sort of approach to care and data collection. Our method was sort of informed by that, and so we would go in and we would not intervene certainly within the first 48, 72 hours, because you want the sort of the organic resources within those teams to come to the fore. You don't want to disrupt leadership. But after 72 hours, that's when you're starting to get a sense of, okay, who is not settling, who continues to be sleeping poorly, who is not connecting. And that's when we would come in and initially we'd meet with command and certainly like the operations people to go, hey, this is my understanding of the event. Can you confirm it? These are the people who I think are affected. And so you get a good sense of that, your ground truth, that information. And that's often really fruitful because there are groups that you might not have understood. Certainly on the Kabul in 2011, there was a RAF explosive ordnance. What are they called? Anyway, like their version of the engineers that deal with unexploded ordnance. And I was told that he did not want to seek support, that he wanted nothing to do with the site. I went in pretty much solo. He said he wouldn't talk to me. So I found out, I met him in a neutral location. I remember meeting him in a cafe on a base at Kabul. And it was very much like, hey, I'm here to meet you as just as a fellow serviceman. Like, how are you doing? And soon after he said he talked about his resistance to talking to me, and he said he had been struggling and he didn't want to disclose that because he didn't want to get sent home. And I gave him the reassurance that the role of critical incident support is to maintain commander's capability, and sometimes that means making difficult decisions and telling and telling soldiers that it is in their best interest and the best interest of the service that they be returned home to receive support, so they may fight another day. And once they get a sense of you, he started to open up, and he expressed his concerns that he did have some quite severe symptoms and he was concerned about being sent home. And when I reassured him that my role was to maintain commander's capability to not send people home without good reason, I think that gave him the confidence to then to talk to me more. Then I was able to sort of go into the more formal approach.
Did you find that a lot there was resistance to talking to you, and that those people were potentially the ones that were struggling in the background, and they didn't want to reveal that because of the fear of having to go home and not being able to finish the operation that they'd committed themselves to?
Yeah, listen, it's a great question, and I conducted, I would estimate, about 1,500 critical incident support screens and Return to Australia psych screen. Probably more, actually. I've never actually sat down, but it would be at least 1,500 over the 14 months I spent in Afghanistan. So my observations would be that it was laughable the number of soldiers that they would underreport symptoms. They would have this bravado as they entered the room with you. It'd be like, oh, I've just got to go talk to this clown, I'll be back in 5 minutes. And an hour and a half later, you've gone through half a box of tissues because these guys are struggling. And you get into the room with them and they are stripped bare. Because that's part of our job. Because what will happen is that they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm completely fine. And you'll look at them and you would have already spoken to their commander and you'll know what their experiences were. And you go, it's interesting as I look through your screen that you talk about you haven't had any exposure, but I know that on this day during this mission, this is what happened. And that's when there's that you inject that accountability. And it's not, it's like, I'm not here to trick you, I'm here to connect with you. if we're going to do this, let's do it properly. Because what we would find, unfortunately, is that during RTAPs, so the Return to Australia site screen that is done before they go home, they were motivated to underreport so not to disrupt their holiday plans, to not disrupt their reconnection with family. And we get that. They just and so what would happen in the 3 to 6 months post-deployment when they did their post-operational site screen, that's when we'd get the true story. But by that point, sometimes their symptoms had become entrenched, their relationships had started to break down. So that's where the Return to Australia site screen was so important, and that's where we needed to do our homework. And those cases where they came in with bravado and you'd go, well, actually, I know that this happened, so talk to me about it. And you would immediately be able to pick up what it, you know, get an accurate read of it.
So how was that for you? Basically, you know, one day you could be potentially waking up in Australia in a pretty standard environment, and then you're getting all these intelligence feeds about what's happened and notification from commanders that they want you on the ground to talk to their team, like, and then you're in an environment that there's still threat around, there's still indirect
yes.
fire, and you're not in a safe location, you're still armed, and that even as in that psychology
yeah.
officer role, and then you're having conversations with guys, you know, and they may be quite unwell, and the room's full of semi-automatic weapons as well. it's not your normal psychology lounge, you know, for the stereotype.
No.
Is it?
Yeah. So this is the great thing about being interviewed by UM, that you've got that context. Mm-hmm. So there are two events that come to mind. One is providing psych support following the green on blue killing incident at Wahab on 29 August 2012, where Pope Martin and Milosevic were killed. And the second was me being put into position with an Australian soldier who was threatened to kill his company sergeant major, his senior soldier. And I have been the one to tell him that his weapon is going to be removed and that he's being sent home.
Yeah.
And that he's going to be assessed for suitability for continued service. So I think the first instance with the green on blue, I remember, so when that attack occurred at Wahab, I was on a nearby base in Kazaruzgan. So I was the psych embedded with 3RER task group. And I knew a lot of soldiers who were attacked. I'd done commando selection myself as a candidate a year earlier, and so a lot of the guys who were unsuccessful, they ended up going to 3RAR. So I knew them well. I knew those guys for probably, you know, for 18 months, developed friendships with them. So there were a number of things happening for me. One, it was, are the guys who I know there, are they okay? How are they coping? And then it was also just that sense of anger that our partner force had done that. But this is where also I'd been on a green on blue task force 6 months earlier, where I was on a Chief of Defence Force task. It was a small team to go into Afghanistan and interview Afghan National Army soldiers about the interpersonal, cultural and operational frictions that were thought to be contributing to green on blue. Because prior to Wahab, we'd had Bert, Gavin and Duffy. We'd had those guys killed at Sauk Bed, I think in 2010. Maybe earlier, and we'd had Lance Corporal Jones. So at that point, we'd already lost four guys to green on blue. So that was really my first taste of field humint, where I was going out, plain clothes, concealed weapon, and it was all about establishing relationships with the ANA, with the Mullahs, with their commanders, to understand that problem, to answer the Chief of Defence Force's questions about, hey, what is contributing to this and how can we mitigate it? And that was fascinating. So when I talk about anger towards the ANA that this had happened, there was also a great sense of compassion, because when I was interviewing, and I interviewed, I'd say 300 or 400 ANA, the number of times, and I'd interview them in small groups, and I'd be with 3 or 4 young ANA soldiers, and they would tell me that when they went home on leave, the Taliban, it was common for them to be held at gunpoint when they go back to their home villages where the Taliban had free rein, and to be told, we know you're ANA, we're going to kill you unless you go back and kill Australians.
Wow.
And I was completely blown away by their restraint.
Because their families are still in those villages as well.
Their families are still in those villages. They're still under threat. And I felt like I had a better understanding of what they were going through. They would be pleading with me with tears in their eyes. It's like, can you please put a VC, a vehicle checkpoint in my village? Because the Taliban are driving past my family's home and taking pot shots at it. They're threatening to kill my brothers because they know I'm ANA. And still, here they are wanting to work with us because this belief and this idea that Afghanistan will be better with a capable security force.
Mm.
So when Hekmatullah killed Pope Martin and Milosevic, there was, yeah, there's anger directed towards him, but there was always also great sympathy to his ANA teammates who were like, you know, they knew that their position was now weaker because he'd done that.
Yeah,
so I think there's a lot going through your head when something like that happens. Not only that, but I was also on a base where obviously we went into a very much a security defense posture, and I knew that there was a interpreter within the compound who was identified to me earlier as being a Taliban sympathizer. I had raised that through the chain of command. I come back six months later, I still see him. So when this occurs, I thought, well, if this is a part of a coordinated attack, he's a threat. I tried, you know, went looking to find him and found him half an hour later underneath our accommodation, asleep in his swag. He was completely oblivious to what had happened, but I didn't know that. So when I found him, I ended up, you know, pulling him out of his sleeping bag at like 1, 2 in the morning. And I remember the look he had on his face when he saw me. Like I was prepared to shoot him.
Yeah.
And he was terrified. And that gave me some confidence that he actually had no knowledge of what was going on. So we simply, you know, put him in a secure place, and we were able to sort of go about securing our compound and thinking what we could do to support the group that had just been attacked.
Wow. Because, I mean, they must know, you know, a lot of cases that it's a suicide attack as well, you know, that if they're going to go and shoot Australian soldiers or any coalition, that they're going to be taken out pretty quickly or arrested if possible.
Yeah. So this is, the perpetrator of Sauk Bed, he was killed on the parade ground after he killed Bert, Gavin and Duffy. Derwish, who killed Lance Corporal Jones, he fled and he was found at his brother's house in Calst months later and was killed by a US team. Fortunately, there was an Australian attached to that mission who was at the rear of the building, and when he went to run out of the rear of the building, he was able to kill him. So there was a sense of national pride there. Unfortunately, Hekmatullah is still at large.
So
it's interesting. And when we looked at the type of Afghan soldier who was likely to perpetrate a green on blue attack, we looked at co-option a lot in terms of, was it more likely to be those soldiers whose families were under pressure from the Taliban. We looked at the incidents of, they're so socialized to violence, like it's not uncommon for a young Afghan boy to be taken with his father to a stoning when he's still, you know, very young. So their exposure to violence is very high. And they don't have conflict resolution mechanisms like we do. If we don't like how we're treated, we've got a number of mechanisms. There they don't have that.
Oh, 100% relate. I treated an Afghan soldier who'd been bludgeoned to death with a rock by a friend of his.
Yeah.
Who they had a disagreement over some bread and some stupid stuff, both fighting in the ANA, and they just crushed his skull. Like, the level of violence that, you know, supposedly these guys were pretty close. So to be an enemy, it takes it to another level, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think this is where this idea of, I think they call it wastad, is saving face. You've got to understand who you're dealing with, and this is where, you know, it's a horrible experience for you to be exposed to. But I, you know, with the intelligence briefings we had before we went in, we heard lots of stories of this, of, you know, there was an ANA sergeant who disciplined one of his soldiers by stripping him naked, hosing him off and putting in a shipping container overnight. So there was little surprise when he was let out the following morning, he just got his rifle and shot him. That's just what happens. And I think this is where you need to, you know, before I went over working with the ANA, interviewing them, a friend of mine who went on to work at a strategic intelligence agency said, and this is not, I'm not meaning to sound elitist or racist, he said, but when, like we, he said, the ANA so often do not have the ability to think critically. It's a part of our education system in Australia. It's a part of our society that our best friend can tell us, you know, a story about how horrible someone is, and automatically we'll think, well, there's another side to this story. And if we're a good friend, we'll go, hey, listen, like, you know, we validate our friend's concerns, but say, hey, listen, what was your part in this conflict? What's your responsibility? So how can we improve from this? Yeah. With the ANA, it was very much a case of, if the mullahs told them black was white, then it was white. And there was a great example of this where we're talking with our interpreters during the green on blue deployment, and our interpreters told us about an Afghan national police officer who told his wife that if she gave birth to a third daughter, he would kill her. So there she is on the, you know, she's giving birth to her third child. It's a girl, and he kills her. And we said to them, I've gone, what is interesting about this is the male determines the sex of the child. To which they responded, yes, Allah determines the sex of the child. And there was no further discussion. You can't talk to that.
Yeah, and somehow they can justify that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they were relatively, those interpreters, they were relatively very well educated. But that's sort of some of the challenges that Afghanistan has.
Yeah. And I think that's probably some of those challenges when people sit back here and are armchair critics on potentially how we behaved in a war zone, just have no idea about the realities of different cultures and different ways of thinking at all.
Yeah, I mean, I was at a party in Melbourne a few years ago. So I was educated in Melbourne and have university friends there that obviously they're now professionals. And one friend in particular who is an architect, I was at a house party with him. And one of his architect friends, sort of a liberal-minded Melburnian, found out what I did. And he said, oh, can you explain to me why we need an army? And I simply smiled at him and I said, I said it must be really lovely living in a world like your head, thinking that we don't need a military. And I said, I'm you know, have a good night. I'm not really interested in talking to you. And that, I suppose that's the level of naivety I think there is with some. And this is where I now live in Queensland. I find that experience to be very different. I think people are a lot more probably realist in their understanding of geopolitics and competition. I haven't had sort of uncomfortable conversations like that. It wasn't so much uncomfortable. It was just completely naive. But this is where I think, yeah, for us veterans, the autopsy and the sort of the perception of wrongdoing that we've all been tainted with over Afghanistan is it's very challenging.
Yeah, a nail on the head there. I sort of asked two questions there, but you did you want to talk about, you know, the return to Australia aspect when you've got someone who wanted to kill their CSM?
Yeah, so spent 14 months in Afghanistan, had roles where I was plain clothes, concealed weapon, bases were being IDF'd, insider threat, went on patrols where there was ID threat. But out of all of those experiences, the time when I was, I felt my life was more threatened than any other was was when I was the psych officer in Tarancout, and I got a phone call from an infantry company commander telling me that he was sending me one of his soldiers who had threatened to kill his CSM, so the senior soldier within the company, and that my role was to inform him that his deployment was over, that he was to be relieved of his weapon, and that he, upon his return to Australia, his suitability for continued service would be conducted. What's better is this company commander had not front-loaded this soldier at all. So this soldier was coming to me without knowing why he'd been sent. And also that he, when I received the phone call, I was told that he was on a helicopter, probably 30 minutes out from Tarancourt, and I was to meet him at the helipad.
Right.
So I didn't have time to consult. It was just one of those moments that I think many of us who work in the military, we kind of enjoy in terms of like, hey, this is not ideal, but you're the best tool for the job. Get it done. I think that that challenge aspect of it was good. But I did have a sense that this was really, really untidy, just in terms of I put myself in this soldier's shoes. Ideally, you would be told by somebody who you knew and trusted, and it's like, you know, that's the type of, you know, person you would want giving you that difficult news. And here I was, a stranger, an officer. So I met with this soldier, brought him into my office, and, you know, he was highly agitated. So this is where one of the abilities you've got to, it's kind of sink or swim. If you're not going to be a good psychologists on operations unless you can manage people, contain people who are highly emotional. So he was very angry. He was verbally abusive. And as a man, that takes quite a bit of management as well, that you don't sort of take that personally. So anyway, I managed to contain him, settle him down. And it's like, listen, it's my, you know, this is a situation that we have been placed in. We are in this together. This is not ideal, but it's my, you know, I've spoken to your company commander. I understand this is, you've threatened to kill your company commander, your company sergeant major, more, you know, on more than one occasion. And that was good in terms of, he was at least, he was comfortable talking about that. And for a while, the enemy was the CSM. And then when I told him, you know, because of your behavior, it's my responsibility to inform you that you're being sent home because you're considered a risk, and that that when you get home, you'll be considered for your suitability for continued service. So then we start, not only is his deployment over, but also his identity as a soldier is over. And the reason why he was so angry at the company sergeant major is he felt that, you know, he wasn't, this company sergeant major wasn't aggressive enough into seeking out contacts. And this guy very much identified as being a warrior. So it was very challenging. So, and then when I told him he was to be relieved of his weapon, which I wasn't, I mean, that was probably the most difficult part, because I had to balance like, well, he's still in a war zone. There's a green on blue threat within the compound that he's entitled to defend himself. So we agreed that he would maintain his weapon at Tarancourt, but be relieved of it when he gets to our MINHAD, which was standard policy anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he, you know, he kind of accepted the difficult position had been placed into. But I think, you know, over the course of about 30 minutes, he started to project all of his fear and his hatred onto me. And there was a point where I formed the belief that he was contemplating shooting me. Because I'm just in a room alone with him. He has his rifle on the floor next to his chair. I'm in a chair sitting across from him, and I have a pistol. And I remember I've gone, this guy might make a grab, might take up his weapon and shoot me. So I shuffled in my chair, and I put my hand on my pistol. And it was enough signal to him that I had understood what he was thinking, and that I was prepared to defend myself. But I remember rehearsing shooting him in the chest, and then having to put him on my shoulders and run him into the roll too, only, you know, 30 meters away. And I just, and that was just one of those incredible moments where time stood still. We looked at each other, and it was just an understanding of how the situation had escalated. And he said he calmed down after that point. He probably, he had a sense that, I don't know, he caught himself. But it was one of those just extraordinary moments. And I remember the interview went for about another 10 minutes. It's like, okay, from here, this is what's going to happen. I've found someone that you can link with. So, you've got a familiar face when you leave my office. I'm going to hand you over to this person. They're going to report to me how you are. And this is what's going to happen when you get back to Australia. And I'm not saying whether this is fair or not. I can see your point of view, but you can't be threatening to kill, fellow Australian soldiers. And it's like, you've also put me in a position, you've projected a lot of hate onto me. Like, this is not okay. And I remember afterwards just being incensed. I'd managed to contain myself during that interview, but afterwards I called the company commander, so a major to a like captain to a major, and I was very direct with him. It's like, listen, I've just been put in a position where I felt I was going to have to shoot him, and I resent that.
Thanks for the heads up, sir.
Thanks for the heads up. Oh, there was no sir. It's like I've gone, this is an abrogation of responsibility, and it nearly got to a situation where I was going to have to exercise my right to defend myself. And I've gone, do you realize I'm here to help people? And I came close to shooting someone today. I've gone, that's really uncool. I've gone, just know that I'm going to be speaking to your commanders about your command as well. Like, this is not okay. But similarly, it's also, there was a part of me that just enjoyed the, I suppose, the intensity of that experience. You certainly went to bed that night feeling like you'd earned your money.
Do you think you manage the confounding factors of all of that vicarious trauma? So hearing, seeing, being there as well, and the high workload.
Yeah, like that's a day-to-day challenge. So I think because I had experience as a psychologist before the military, because I'd done a lot of military training, I'd done special forces selection by that point, and for commandos was unsuccessful, might I add. But that's probably a good reminder for everyone not to do selection when you're 37. That's too old. I was told that I would have been taken as a soldier, but as an officer, my planning was slower than the others. And it's like, well, I am a psychology officer, so give me a break. But that wasn't considered. It's like a commando mate said. He goes, when it becomes or when unconventional becomes inconvenient. So I accepted that. But this is where, in terms of being able to manage vicarious trauma, working in a high operational threat area, and the constancy of it. So for me, it was all about, as long as I got to the gym in the morning and was able to have, breakfast or dinner or lunch, generally, I was able to get through. But this is where it did eventually take a toll on me, and I did burn out. So instances like, oh, in when I was at Patrol Base Anaconda, I was there when a Afghan national brought his son to the to, into the compound with a gangrenous lower limb, forearm, and he had a Coke can wrapped around it, believing that that would somehow, that would sort of make it all better. And you were exposed to things like that, like at Roll Two, when you would see children come in and they'd had their hands blown off with butterfly mines, when you had, Sapper Curtis McGrath with his double lower limb amputation, when you were dealing with soldiers in the SOTG rollover, which killed Nate Gallagher and Merv McDonald. And I'd done selection with Nate the year before. So I think this is where, as a psych within the military, you were used to dual roles. You had to balance, I'm going to see someone who I know, that I've got a relationship with. I need to be able to disentangle my personal and professional judgments. And that's okay. You're okay at that. But over time, you do get worn down. And this is where self-care and having team members that you can consult with and then can carry some of the load when you need a break is important. But as psychs, we usually deploy in pairs, so we don't have that redundancy. So this is where what's really important is what happens in the sort of the when you return home and you go through your own debriefing and you have some leave and you're just very conscious about putting into practice what you've just spent months telling others to do. So I will say that the level of care given to us was variable, that the worst of it was at the end of my final deployment in 2012, which was probably the most intense with the SOTG rollover and the green on blue at Wahab. We returned home and in December, and the unit had already commenced stand down. And there was a policy that we were not to be seen by uniform psychologists. We were to find our own civilian psychologist. And fortunately, I'd had some supervision by a professor in Sydney, so I arranged for him to do it. But he had no context about what my experience had been. And to be honest, most of that interview was him asking questions about what happened next. So that was really challenging in terms of you began to, your sleep would deteriorate. And this is where there have been times in my military career where I think it's common in the health professions, also in, the combat corps. I think it's maybe a character trait or flaw or whatever you want to call it, where you push yourself to the point where you are going to burn out, and there's going to be a decline in your health, and it's about how you dig yourself out of that. And this is where, for me personally, I went on to be diagnosed with a mental health disorder. Which was really no surprise to me, because I think across a lifespan that we will experience, I think it's quite normal to experience depression, trauma-related symptoms. But mine, I think, compounded with burnout and fatigue, just meant that that I did become unwell. And for the first time in my life, actually, I had to, had to put my hand up and ask, command and the health service for help.
And that's really the takeaway, isn't it? That no one's immune, no matter how much you know or
Yes.
what your training has been and your experience, no one is immune. And if you know something's not right in yourself, you've got to put your hand up and ask for help.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you got a pretty good response when you did that, didn't you? You got
I did.
supported. Yeah.
I did. So this is where I think part of my motivation to come on to your podcast was to is just share my story. And that is of someone who between 2009 and 2012 was away up to 6 months of each of those years, providing support on the ground. And it took a toll on me. And that was a function of was fatigue, exposure, and it began to really distort my worldview. When you begin to see the world very differently, you start to look at it as being high threat. As what I experienced was, I would myself, I was underreporting symptoms because you didn't want to miss out on the next opportunity to contribute. And for me, it was about the satisfaction I got on deployment, being on the ground and providing what I would describe as instrumental help. You can go into a situation and you can be there, but not actually change anything. I wanted to change things for the better. And for me, it was like I have this theoretical understanding of what is good, what good looks like, and I have enough experience to temper that idealism with what actually works on the ground. And with humility, I was able to connect with the soldiers and get their sense of things as well. So I became addicted to that. And it became, and it, and what happened is that the fatigue set in and I just wasn't looking after myself because I was so focused on looking after other people. And it's kind of like a distraction in a way, like, whether you use alcohol or drugs or go to the movies or whatever it is, like these are distractions. And that formed part of my distraction. I understand that that sounds a little like that's a bit of impression management and it's making me sound to be this idealistic person. I'm certainly not. I'm selfish as the next person. But what happened is that it got to the point where when I wasn't sleeping, when I became irritable, when I was not taking, I was not getting enjoyment from the things that used to bring me enjoyment. I used to, you know, I used to, I was worrying about my children a lot. I was worrying about, you know, about what it was for them to grow up in this world. And around this time, my wife passed away in an accident, and that, I think that increased. I mean, that obviously it's a dramatic life change. I was on
Absolutely.
course. I was on course when that happened. My children were only young at that time, so it was very much a lot of sort of significant events occurring within a couple of years of each other. And
Yeah.
this is where I think it got to the point where my journey was initially, it was okay. Certainly after my wife passed away, which is something I not expected, we joke about it. It's like, I'm the one that's going to die in Afghanistan. Like you live in Sydney, you live in Western Victoria, wherever it was, and you'll be fine. And so for that to happen, all of a sudden, like things, life is not as you expected it. This is a complete curveball. You now have two young children without a mother, and it is up to you. So in a way, I felt that I'd never been more important. It's like, okay, I've achieved what I wanted in the military. Now it's my focus to look after myself, because you can't look after others unless you're well. And it's also, you've got two young children who've lost their mum. So this idea about children are born through us, this idea about I could look at my son who had only been weaned 3 months earlier, and I looked at him as a fellow human being to go, not, you know, even beyond being his dad. It's like, this is a Greek tragedy, what's happened to you, and whatever you need from me, you will have. But I wasn't well. So this is where initially I relied on all those coping mechanisms that I told other people about, you know, social support, surrounding yourself by supportive people, exercise, sleep, nutrition. But what had happened, I'd gotten to a point where none of those things were effective. I'd gone too deep for those things to work. So I remember trying to work, and I simply couldn't concentrate. I couldn't remember, and I called command and said, "Listen, I can't. I'm not sleep. I haven't slept in days, despite me exercising." And I said, "I can't. I can't. I can't concentrate. I can't remember anything." And I think because of the contribution that I had made, that when I did ask for that help, it was very forthcoming. And I was linked to, through my network, I got to see a good psychologist early. And this is something that's important for anyone listening, that when you put your hand up for help, it can take a while to find the right people. And it's okay if you don't have a connection with the first or second psychologist you see, that it's okay to go, don't feel embarrassed to say, actually, this is not working for me, I'm not connecting with you. So that happened. I found a good psychologist. I felt, you know, understood. I was referred to psychiatry. I was put on medication, and this was quite extraordinary for me, because I was so committed to sort of a non-pharmaceutical approach to mental health. It's like, I think I understand what my body and brain needs to be well, but I'd exhausted that, and my brain chemistry just was, I imagine if my brain was put in a blender and then analyzed, it'd be like, you don't have any serotonin in it. Like there's no, your neurochemistry is now out. And I remember the psychiatrist, who was a very gruff, I won't mention his name, some people may know him, very gruff, about to retire psychiatrist from, he's got a practice in Brisbane. And I had confidence in his authority and his experience. And when he turned to me after I told him my story, and he said, "I don't think you realize how bad you are." And that was one of those profound moments in life where you had been pretending, and partly to convince yourself, and to have someone with that authority and experience say that to you, you can't help but listen. So then he prescribed me medication. I go and get that script filled. I'm driving home. I call a friend who I deployed with, and I said, "I've just seen a psychiatrist and they've prescribed me this medication, and I'm not taking it." And this is wonderful. It's like easy to be friends during the good times. So my friend, She says, pull your car over immediately and take a tablet. And because I'd recognize it, my thinking was compromised, that I trusted her. So that's exactly what I did. And 2 weeks later, I woke up feeling not better, but better than I had been. There was that sort of that, there was that one, the needle had moved a perceptible amount for me to go, actually, I'm no longer at rock bottom. I'm a little bit higher than that. And that began that journey of recovery.
Wow. And for listening to your trusted friend and your trusted network and your health professionals, which is hard to do when you are a health professional yourself sometimes.
And this is where I'll just sort of reinforce the value of humility. And this is where, certainly within psychology, we can read someone's file, we can form hypotheses about, hey, this is what I think this person's going to look like, this is what they're going to say. And you get into the room with them and they're very different. And it's that idea about divesting yourself from your presuppositions and going, actually, the best information source is right here, right now. I'm having a human connection with someone, and that's the most important thing. And similarly, that's what I had to let go of. It's like my friend is telling me right here, right now, that this is what I need to do to get better. And because we had deployed together and I did trust her, that was the difference.
So then you started to find your new normal event, in life, and you had a bit of a career change into intelligence with the military and stepped away from being clinical psych for a while. And I imagine your background would have been hugely beneficial when it come to human intelligence and that. And then you transitioned out and you work in this interesting space now as a consultant in the business and government agencies with stakeholder management, influence processes, and negotiations. So that to me says manipulate the human mind.
Wonderful. This is coming back full circle and manipulation. Excellent. So I'm on Source Operations Corps. So, I transferred to intelligence. And that's where I spent the last 7 years of my military career before being medically discharged and moving on with my life. So, in that 7 years, like you said, because of my psychological knowledge, I specialized in human intelligence. So, that is source operations and psychological operations. So, I am on Source Operations course in the Gold Coast, and I'm in a vehicle with an agent from one of our strategic agencies, and he knows that I have a psychology background. And whenever we're alone, we're having these, interesting conversations about psychology. And I turned to him and I said, mate, we can't really manipulate people, can we? And he was an agent who had deployed all around the world. He dealt with North Koreans. He'd dealt with all these interesting troops. And he turned to me and said, no, we can't. We can shape people to make certain decisions. And this is interesting. So if you look at the principles of persuasion that they use in marketing and Cialdini's principles in terms of liking, reciprocity, consistency, all of these things that you can read about in the literature. What we have in the military and in the intelligence community is we also have the ability to use fear and coercion. And that may be, provide me this information, or I'm going to leak to your network that you are working with us. So that would be an example, perhaps, of manipulation. But you get to do that once, because people are more motivated by revenge than they are love. If you do that to someone, you better have a good plan afterwards. They're going to come after you hard. So this is where what I learned about this idea of manipulating people, and this happened in psychology as well, that you never ever want to be in a position where you have to use that. What is far more, I think, humane and enduring, because psychology is about changing people's behavior in an agreed way. So It is about, essentially, it's about being a good person. If you are a good person and you connect with someone and you say, I say this with love and it's in your best interest, we both agree on that. I understand there are barriers for you doing the thing that we've agreed to because it's hard. It's hard to have that difficult conversation with your partner. It is hard to not comfort eat instead of exercise or whatever it might be. It's like those challenges are understood, but we have to make a decision here. Are we going to do something about it, or are we going to complain about the results we never got from the work we didn't do? That kind of thing. So this is where in human intelligence it comes very much about if and Michael Voss's book, Never Split the Difference. He was a hostage negotiator in the FBI. The fundamental principle of his model is that in a hostage negotiation, when the aggrieved person has felt understood, when you get to that's right, when they tell you their problems and you can say it back to them in a way that they feel understood and that they feel cared for, and they go, yeah, that's right. That's when you can start to change behavior. And you can't do it until you get there. And that's where, when we talk about manipulation of the mind, like clearly when I started psychology as a first year student, I thought this is going to be great. I'm going to get discounts. I'm going to be able to sleep with attractive women, all of that kind of stuff. And it's complete nonsense.
And
It
unethical,
was so, it was so
might
unethical,
I
and this is great. It's just not realistic.
Yeah,
It's and you learn ultimately that if you're genuine, you find where you fit, and you genuinely want to help someone, then that's your best chance of contributing, and that's what it is to be human.
Tom, fascinating career. Thanks for coming on and sharing your story and your vulnerability in that, because there's some really good take homes there, I think, for a lot of people, and particularly those that work in health. And thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for M. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk. And yeah, I hope we're able to continue this. And I look forward to hearing, you continuing to contribute to this body of work that's going to promote understanding. And even talking with you today, there's a sense of it's lovely to be able to reflect on my own journey. And I hope that it's of some value to others.
It will be. Thank you.